Chapter 6. Remote Conspiracies. For the first 2 weeks in July, President Poincaré waited patiently for his allies around the Tsar to ready the Russian forces for war. The vast distances and relatively primitive communications of Russia made mobilization a more time-consuming business than in the compact and well-ordered nations of Europe, and the French leader was at first indulgent of the proverbial sluggishness of the Russian bear. By mid-July, however, Poincaré had grown nervous. Anxious to see how the Russians were progressing and determined, in George Thompson's words, to put a little steel into the spinal column of that powerful but dubious ally, Poincaré embarked at Calais on the cruiser France on July 15 for St. Petersburg. 6 days later, he and his prime minister, René Viviani, were received with the pomp only an autocrat can muster at the Russian capital. At the Tsar's summer residence, the Peterhof, Poincaré acquainted himself with the imperial family, particularly the Tsar's four daughters, to each of whom he presented a diamond wristwatch, all the while eyeing them surreptitiously but calculatingly, mindful of the salacious gossip revolving around their relations with the sinister holy man, Rasputin. Poincaré presented the Tsar and Tsarina with Gobelin tapestries and a set of gold fittings for the Tsar's touring car. Soon the French president and the Russian emperor were in deep conversation, if the one-sided oration at the sententious little Poincaré delivered as the Tsar sat silent and lackluster could be called a conversation. Tsar Nicholas II was no man to lead an empire. Lethargic and vacillating by nature, under the thumb of his German-born wife, Alexandra, his every movement was protected by hundreds of guards, yet he had no one to guard him against the venal incompetence and flattering toadies who formed his official entourage. Gormykin, president of the Council of Ministers, was good for nothing more than curling up on the sofa with a third-rate novel, a cigarette dangling between his cracked lips. Maklakov, the Minister of the Interior, owed his prominence to his ability to amuse the young Grand Duchesses with his animal imitations. He'd play the panther and bound wildly about on the floor, while the girls cowered and shrieked in mock terror. The Minister of War, V.A. Sukomlinov, was another dubious character, a compulsive gambler who was always in debt. Shortly before Poincaré's visit he had given an interview, "Russia is Ready," widely published in the Paris press, which sparked a flurry on the stock exchange, which Sukomlinov was able to turn to his profit. One of his numerous creditors was in close touch with German intelligence. The real powers behind the papier-mâché facade of the Tsarist court were other men. Russia's foreign minister, S.D. Sazonov, had played the most important role in the Balkan intrigues of the previous decade. Alexander Izvolsky, formerly foreign minister and in 1914 ambassador to France, played a diplomatic role scarcely inferior to that of Sazonov. Then there were the grandees of Panslavism, clustered on the general staff and in the high command, foremost among them the Tsar's uncle, Grand Duke Nicholas, commander-in-chief of the army. It was Sazonov with whom Poincaré conducted his most important discussions. Sazonov, ably assisted by his predecessor Izvolsky, had been and remained a hard bargainer. 2 years before, Poincaré had insisted that France would not be drawn against her will into a war originating in the Balkans. Poincaré had told Sazonov at that time, "Don't count on us for military aid in the Balkans, even if you are attacked by Austria." In August of 1912, Poincaré had reiterated his government's position, "Should the occasion arise, we will fulfill our obligations. Don't rely on us, however, to aid you militarily in the Balkans, even if you are attacked by Austria, or if in attacking her you bring about the intervention of Germany." Poincaré, Les Responsabilités de la Guerre, page 53. Despite these and numerous other warnings, all of them calculated to ensure that the outbreak of war be timed to French convenience, in July 1914 Poincaré found himself dependent on the Tsarist Empire. The carefully laid plots of Sazonov and Izvolsky had entangled the French leadership. The road back to Alsace and Lorraine would indeed make a detour through Serbia, at a heavy toll. Poincaré's conduct in St. Petersburg bore witness to his acquiescence in the Balkan entanglement. He busied himself in cheering up Serbia's ambassador to Russia, Spalajkovic, whom he told, "Have no fear. Serbia has a warm friend in our country. Spaljkovic, whose superior in Belgrade, the Secretary of Foreign Affairs, once commented, "I always wonder whether Spaljkovic is more scoundrel than fool, or as stupid as he is crooked," became the first Serbian diplomat to learn of Poincaré's wholehearted decision to commit France to Serbia and Russia, come what may. The support for Serbia which the French leaders manifested in St. Petersburg was accompanied with a show of hostility toward Austria-Hungary. Prime Minister Viviani, while in the Russian capital, sent a directive to all of France's diplomats stationed abroad, which conveyed this statement made by Poincaré: "France will not tolerate Austrian interference in Serbian affairs." At a diplomatic reception given by Poincaré in the Winter Palace, he made a shocking personal attack on the Austrian ambassador to Russia, Count Sapri, in terms that left Count Sapri beside himself, as the Spanish ambassador, the Count of Cartagena, would later write in his memoirs of a diplomat. Even Poincaré, stung by the shocked criticism that accompanied his diplomatic faux pas, later felt constrained to offer a limp defense of his outburst in his book L'Union Sacrée, where he writes, "I pointed out to the ambassador that Serbia has friends in Russia who would no doubt be astonished to find her the target of harsh measures, and that surprise might be shared in other countries that were friends of Russia." At the very least, Poincaré might have offered his regrets to the Austrian minister on the violent and brutal death of his country's heir to the throne. The remark, coming as it did at a diplomatic reception, testified not only to a lamentable lack of self-control but also to a positive willingness to give offense and provocation. Besides his conferences with Sazonov and Izvolsky, with whom Poincaré had worked very closely in Paris, both on matters of diplomacy and more sordid business involving the cultivation of France's biggest journalists, Poincaré also met with Grand Duke Nicholas, commander of the Russian army. The Grand Duke was a giant, 6 feet 7 inches tall, with a bearing as impressive as his height. Although well known for his brutality, he was immensely popular with the rank and file, for, to the great delight of the mujiks, he was prone to administer savage thrashings to even the most highly placed of his subordinates, or to deliver a swift kick to the ample behind of an offending general, thereby instituting a democracy of punishment that would be exceeded only by Stalin's mass purges of the officer corps in the 1930s. Nicholas and his brother, Grand Duke Peter, were supported in their Panslavism by their wives Anastasia and Militsa, the fiery daughters of the King of Little Montenegro, Nicholas. King Nicholas, a perpetual moneygrubber whose searches for a wealthy wife inspired Lehar's Merry Widow, ruled a state linked closely to Serbia historically and ethnically but which, under his rule, inclined toward placating Austria. His daughters, heiresses to a long heritage of banditry and vendetta, were as bold as they were enchanting. They laughed at the toadying of the courtiers around the imperial family, and seemed always to be spoiling for a fight with someone. During the French state visit their preferred enemy was Germany, and the two spitfires quickly wrapped Poincaré around their little fingers. At the banquet which the French ambassador, Maurice Paleologue, was giving the Tsar and his president, Alexandra and Militsa themselves decorated the tables, setting bouquets of flowers everywhere. Before the sullen Poincaré they placed a gold candy box, which, when opened, proved to contain a half pound of earth from his native Lorraine, the focus of his ambitions for revenge throughout the course of his career. To further stir Poincaré's blood, Grand Duke Nicholas staged a great military review on the parade ground at Krasnoye Selo. Together with the Tsar they watched 60,000 troops swagger by, massive men, barrel-chested and mustachioed, with shouts that evoked wolf packs bounding on the endless steppe. The horses of the Cossacks thundered by as if maddened by vodka. Most inspiring of all for the French president, the Russian bands filled the air with French military marches, Le Regiment de Sambre et Meuse, Fiers Enfants de la Lorraine, until Poincaré was transfigured with pride. At the end of the parade Poincaré ventured a prediction about the Russian forces. "They will be in Berlin by All Saints' Day," he forecast. As to Russian troops in Berlin, the little lawyer from Lorraine was 31 years premature. Nor would the Tsar or his relatives command them. But Poincaré had allowed himself to be convinced. Russia's 5-million-man army would sweep aside the Kaiser's severely outnumbered forces and be watering their horses at the Spree in a few weeks. And by Christmas, Strasbourg and Metz would be French again. Now that Poincaré and his diplomats were set on war, they would make every arrangement to camouflage the real circumstances of its onset, they would temporize, tell comforting lies, stage full-blown deceptions, even carry out forgeries, all matters in which well-trained diplomats excel when professional duty demands them. Such subterfuges, of course, would be so discreet that very few would even have an inkling of them. If worst came to worst, the perpetrators would deny them in shocked tones. In this spirit, Poincaré, who left St. Petersburg for France on July 23, denied having come to any understanding with the Russians. According to him, M. Viviani and I relaxed and rested. Strictly speaking, he'd learned nothing new, we have no news, or practically none. As the historian Fabre Luce wrote, Poincaré acted the role of deaf-mute. The French president took great pains not to direct any potentially incriminating memoranda to the Quai d'Orsay. As the French delegation was preparing to board the France, while final embraces were being exchanged, Sazonov had scribbled the text of a final joint Russian-French declaration, then proffered it to Poincaré. The Frenchman gave a start on reading the draft. The two governments have established a perfect correspondence of their views and of their aims for the maintenance of the balance of power in Europe, especially on the Balkan Peninsula. Poincaré wrote later in L'Union Secrète, Viviani and I thought the wording, in which there was no mention of peace, would commit us too much to following Russia's policy in the Balkans. Accordingly, we modified the draft so as to safeguard our freedom of action. Page 279. This hypocritical claim, belied by his every action at the time, Poincaré sought to bolster further by the claim that during the all-important days just before the outbreak of the war, everyone knew that M. Viviani and I were on the high seas, far from both France and Russia. In politics, hypocrisy is a virtue. Unfortunately for the politicians, history is apt to pursue them and reveal their self-serving stories and evasions for the lies they were. Poincaré's efforts to cover his tracks were soon exposed. The British ambassador to St. Petersburg, Sir George Buchanan, a staunch opponent of Germany and an intimate friend of France's Paleologue, revealed Poincaré's secret arrangements with the Russians in his memoirs. Buchanan had learned of them from Paleologue shortly after Poincaré had sailed back to France. Immediately after being apprised of the real situation, Buchanan wired London that Poincaré would shield the Serbs, that there was no longer any question of the French leader acting as a check on Russian Panslavists, and that the French and the Russians had solemnly ratified the commitments of the alliance. On the same report, Sir Eyre Crowe, Assistant Secretary in the Foreign Office, wrote this summary: "The time has passed when we might treat with France to keep Russia within bounds. It is clear that France and Russia have decided to throw down the gauntlet." After Poincaré's departure, Paleologue resumed his role as the most important Frenchman in Russia. During the last 10 days of July, he would carry out his role as master deceiver in a virtuoso performance. Poincaré's last instructions to Paleologue, issued just before the France weighed anchor, were explicit: "It is imperative that Sazonov remain firm and that we support him." These words have been documented from several sources, most notably the records of secret Russian diplomacy, which the Soviets, in the first flush of their revolutionary ardor, were so indelicate as to publish in Pravda in the winter of 1917-1918. Despite his denials, Poincaré in fact maintained contact with both Paris and St. Petersburg on his return voyage. According to Paleologue, he himself had sent important information to his president on board the France, and had received additional instructions from Poincaré, including a telegram impressing upon him the need to give full support to the imperial government. French historian Fabre Luce, in his outstanding L'Histoire d'Emiquie, summed up the facts of Poincaré's return trip: "The travelers, Poincaré and Viviani, knew that the Russian government did not envisage a Serbian acceptance of Austria's demands, which in any case depended on Russia, and had decided to mobilize against Austria in the event of an Austro-Serbian break in relations. Hence they knowingly cabled St. Petersburg a renewed promise of support." Poincaré, however, was bent on his role of deaf-mute, and the archives of the Quai d'Orsay would be manipulated so as to make it seem that communications with the outside world were held to an absolute minimum. Some months after the beginning of the war, the French government would publish a collection of documents purporting to demonstrate its own innocent conduct in Germany's aggressive behavior in the period just before the war's outbreak. In that collection, called the French Yellow Book, there was more than one glaring omission, as would be revealed after the war. Indeed, all the messages which passed between Poincaré and Paleologue as the French president steamed back to France would be either wholly or partially suppressed. Revealingly enough, the entire text of the agreement between Sazonov and Poincaré, in which Poincaré had gratuitously interpolated a deceitful reference to their mutual desire for peace, was missing from the Yellow Book. Fabre Luce remarks. It is a curious thing that the telegram which, because of that addition, might be taken by naive readers as an indication of the pacific purpose of the travelers, was omitted from the first Yellow Book published by the French government. Was it done to make people forget that Viviani's addition didn't at all square with the policies actually followed during subsequent days? Or to keep up the fiction that the travelers had not been apprised of anything and had taken no action? Again, the critical telegrams, which Poincaré dispatched at Paleologue, ordering him to back the Russians to the limit, are not to be found in the Yellow Book. Later the French president would piously declare, "We know nothing of any remote conspiracies," echoing Paleologue, who made the brazen claim that since the head of state and the head of government were at sea, and since they were only imperfectly acquainted with the situation, they were unable to send him any instructions. This sort of manipulation of the truth would be followed by numerous fake documents, texts of messages published with compromising passages omitted, invented passages inserted, and-out forgeries. From the morning of July 24, 1914, not a single official text, either French or Russian, can be accepted at face value by a serious historian, unless it has been subjected to the most thoroughgoing scrutiny. The student of history, in dealing with the outbreak of the First World War, finds himself inundated by a flood of lies and circumlocutions. Needless to say, at the time millions of naive people were led astray. Millions and tens of millions still believe the official falsehoods, long after they were revealed for what they were. Some of the most glaring deceptions have gone almost unnoticed, due to the vested interests of establishment politicians and court historians, who have made untruth a weapon of state in order to capture the masses, render them mindless, drive them into collective hysteria, and then frustrate any possibility that in calmer days they might learn from their mistakes and come to doubt the word of the power elite. We shall learn how the story of the mobilization of the various national armies has been distorted, and how in particular the leaders of France and Russia faked the date of Austria's and Russia's mobilizations, driving 8 million men to their deaths. It would not be until 8 years after that fateful July of 1914 that Poincaré, driven to the wall by the League of Human Rights, would be forced to confess that the document which he had flaunted more than any other, the Austrian notice of mobilization, had been faked. His retraction would not restore life to a single one of the dead at Chemin des Dames, Verdun, or Tannenberg.